There are millions upon millions of indigenous people in heaven right now who are thankful for Christopher Columbus, who are thankful for the British Empire, who are thankful for the Portuguese Empire and the other, the French, I guess even the French, who brought the who brought the faith to them they hadn't heard before.
Welcome to the Stand Firm Podcast. We're recording this episode on Tuesday, October 15th, 2024. I'm Nick Landon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm joined by Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and by J.D. Koch of St. Luke's Anglican Church on Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. How are you gentlemen today?
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, good, Nick. Thanks.
Matt, I saw you recommended the Bible to your daughter as a suitor of hers is looking to familiarize himself with Anglicanism. I think this is actually a serious question, though, that I'm asked all the time. Are there good books we can recommend in addition to the Bible, which, as we all know, are like Jesus, ultimately Anglican?
I mean, I'm sure there are. One problem with, not problem, I just don't, Anglicanism is so varied. You know, you have Anglo-Catholics, you have evangelicals, you have broad church kind of charismatic people. So we're all going to recommend different books, right?
Yeah.
In all seriousness, after I said the Bible, I did say this to him. I just told him to read the 39 articles and we'll talk about it. And that's my standard answer now.
And there are several good explications of those articles.
Yeah. Oh, and there's
even those are under contention, though. Those are also much hotly debated. But I think the prayer book is the number one. I mean, other than the Bible, I think, you know, hand somebody our prayer book and have them really consider the offices and read through the two Eucharistic services, the baptism, burial, you know, to the extent they're interested, and say, you know, let's talk about what a life would look like being formed through the repetition of these offices and these services over the course of your lifetime. And I think that's a very compelling argument, particularly for either newlyweds or new parents, you know, with respect to who are genuinely Christian and want to submit themselves to a formative process that wasn't made up yesterday and has obviously scriptural basis, but also has literally stood the test of time. I mean, I think it's, I find that very compelling in my own life, and also have found it fairly fruitful to people who are even surprised 10 years into their worship that they're Anglicans. They say, what? They know we're Anglican. What is that? I say, well, you know, let's have a talk.
I guess what I'm really asking is, when is it time to publish the Stand Firm Guide to Anglicanism?
That's a great question. We have a scholar on our
and all our free time, right?
Yeah. I think we are. I think we're doing that, you know, I think we're doing that by default. Just this is what this is. This is how you should understand Anglicanism. And if you deviate from it, you should come on the show and we can talk it out. So, you know, if our listener
are the arbiters,
enraged by something we say, then please reach out and we can have a chat.
Well, guys, as we record this episode, yesterday was, depending on your perspective, of course, either Columbus Day or Indigenous Peoples Day. My Google Calendar automatically provided both. This is an issue every year, of course, although we saw an interesting intersection this year with a Twitter interaction between Allie Beth Stuckey and Tim Whitaker, who is the new evangelicals guy, about what the least of these means in Matthew 25. Now, Allie Beth Stuckey asserted that it refers to persecuted Christians, while Whitaker presumably believes it refers to any downtrodden person, noting that, quote, Christians weren't a thing when Jesus used the phrase. Now, it connects with Columbus Day in that the indigenous peoples Columbus came into contact with would certainly be categorized with the least of these by Whitaker and his ilk today, despite whatever might have actually been going on at the time. So, guys, maybe we start with Matthew 25. What does the text say? And to whom do you think Jesus is referring when he refers to the least of these?
So Matthew 25 is it's this particular parable comes at the end of a series of parables that are eschatological in focus, right? They're focused on the final appearing, the coming of the kingdom of Christ. And the parable, the last parable, is the separation of the sheep and the goats. And I don't know about you guys, but in my seminary, this parable was like a clobber passage for the left. I mean,
yeah,
because of the interpretation that the new evangelicals guy uses. I mean, the idea was, in this parable, it's not what you believe. It's not whether you believe in Jesus or not. It's not what, I mean, you can be a Buddhist and care for the least of these. You can go to prison and visit the prisoners. You can go to the hospital and visit the sick. You can clothe the naked. But doing all those things is what makes you a sheep. That's how you become a sheep. And it's not necessarily who your religious allegiance lies with, whether it's Jesus, with Buddha, or with Muhammad. It really is important that you're just a good, generous person. That was the mainline reading that I was given in seminary. And then, of course, there's the now the more evangelical woke version, which is very similar, but it's used as a kind of a political football. Like if you're not supporting leftist policies, which will help the prisoners or help the least of these, then you're not being a good follower of Jesus. This is kind of like what we were talking about last week. So it's the political glaze that's piled on top of this text is really bad, and this text is one of the more abused Bible passages, I think, in our modern day. If maybe second to "Judge not, lest you be judged," but it's right up there with that.
That's close. Those are neck and neck
on that level. So I mean, if you think about what Jesus is doing in that text, eschatologically, he is a week away, or I'm sorry, a few days away from crucifixion. Maybe this is a Wednesday. It's a Thursday. It's Holy Week. He's going to be crucified. He's been rejected by the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the elders, the priests. Everybody has rejected him. He's already issued a number of warnings to his own followers that they're going to be hated, just like he has been hated, and they're going to be reviled by the world. In chapter 24 of Matthew's gospel, it's all about discourse, where he says very clearly, you are on the outs. You're going to be handed over to kings and handed over and beaten in the synagogues. You're going to be cast aside. And so already there's Jesus has set up a dichotomy in his disciples' minds between them and the world, and how the world treats them and how they're to treat each other. And then you go back even further in Matthew's gospel. I think it's in Matthew chapter 12. Jesus makes that dichotomy or drives that dichotomy down to the deepest level when his mother and brothers are outside waiting for him, and he's inside some house with his disciples, and he doesn't go out to see his family, which is shocking in a first century context. And someone comes and says, hey, your brothers are out there looking for you. And he says, well, my mother and my brothers and my fathers, my sisters are those who do my father's will. And by that, he means his disciples.
And not just the 12.
No, not just well. I could decide followers, yeah. Like people who do his father's will. And the first and foremost of the things you must do the father's will is to believe in the son, to trust in the son. So maybe know the language of the church, and well, Jesus uses that language of church actually, but the language of maybe Christian hadn't been set up yet. So in that sense, the nomenclature that the new evangelical guy uses is right. There wasn't the nomenclature of Christian yet, but there was certainly
followers of Christ,
followers of Christ, right? And so when Jesus comes to this point and he says, I'm separating the sheep and the goats, and you can distinguish between the two by how they treat the least of these my brothers, I think it's very clear to any reader of Matthew's gospel that he means his followers are going to love one another, and by that love they're going to reveal who they are, and they're also going to be hated in the world,
right? And because hatred, of him, they'll be in prison, right? They'll be sick, they'll be naked.
Exactly. And so much so that it's an interesting parable when the goats say, well, when did we see you naked and didn't clothe you, or in prison, didn't visit you, or sick and didn't help you? And the implication could be, and I might be stretching a little bit here, but that they've been doing a lot of good works. I mean, they've been giving to the poor and giving to visiting people in prison and all that kind of thing. But they have neglected and reviled the church. So they're a little bit dumbfounded because they didn't know that's what Jesus was asking them. And in fact, they've neglected and hated and despised and reviled the church. So the whole thing, I think, it comes down to one mark that distinguishes a sheep from a goat is the sheep love the church, the goats hate them. And our deconstructionist ex-evangelical friends should take that into account when they use this text against the church.
Right. Well, that's well said. I mean, I wholeheartedly agree. I think it's another ham-fisted liberation theology, Marxist appeal to class struggle that is trotted out. You know, and we heard that even in parts of our seminary. We didn't have universalistic sort of just straight up works universalism as you described. So any Trinity people listening, rest assured. But we certainly had certain people would have a knowing look about them, you know, when they give a talk or a sermon and sort of implying that all of us rich people, you know, should be quaking our boots a little bit when we hear this, because it's clearly about wealthy people having disdain for the poor and needy. And so that, you know, that infected even self-consciously evangelical seminary, you know, what, 20 years ago now or so.
Sure.
But it's so obviously used, and it's so readily used, trotted out, not in like at times when people want to make a class warfare point, basically, you know, liberation theology point. It's often used like the other one that's I was just reminded is often misused in John, was it John 12, when Jesus talks about they'll know we're Christians by our love, or 13, excuse me, you know, and that's also often brought out as like, you know, you're being unloving, you're being unkind, you're not, you know, they're not going to know we're Christians. And of course he says, you know, you're Christians by your love for one another. You know, again, it's this familial, relational witness to the world that see how they loved each other. You know, this is the idea that is supposed to be communicated, and well, is communicated and supposed to be the reflection of God's love for us to each other, first love, and then, you know, love God and love your neighbors yourself. And that is the witness to the world, not just random acts of what the world even would consider love, you know, because a lot of what the world considers love is not love, according to the Bible. And so, but yeah, Matt, I totally agree with your exegesis there. It's well said. And, you know, I thought that the response to the initial tweet was glorious, because not only was it falsified by exegetical grounds, the claim that no Christian theologian had ever made this argument was so quickly refuted, you know, like receipt after receipt after receipt of people saying just that was glorious. It was like, I wanted to tweet, that's why I stay on this platform.
I'm never leaving this app. Yeah,
that's right.
It seems to have a corollary, and I'll be frank and admit that this is not something that I really had considered exegetically until very recently. I just assumed this was a word to cut to the heart of those who would not help the poor or visit the prisoner or provide clothing to the naked. But upon reflection, it does seem of a piece with the descriptions of the radical generosity and hospitality of the early church. Like in Acts 2 and in Acts 4, they're described as being well regarded by the people who are not part of the church, but it's because of how well they're taking care of not the city at large, but each other.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That was the characteristic of the early church. And I think in a lot of ways it is characteristic of the modern day church. But I think the problem is that the presence of ex-evangelical deconstructing people coming out of the church and reviling it has colored the perception of the church on the part of the world. So the world looks at the church and they hear the loudest voices are these deconstructors. The loudest voices are these ex-evangelicals, the ones who get into the media, the ones who get invited to go and talk on Good Morning America or whatever it might be. Are the people who are bitter and angry about their past. We talked about them last week. And so that's the narrative that you hear. But I think all of us, I can speak for Good Shepherd, definitely, and in the churches that I know of around here, the amount of sacrificial, self-giving love on the part of ordinary parishioners for the poor in our church, in our congregation, is, you know, brings tears to my eyes sometimes, because it's amazing. And it's not something you would see necessarily in the Moose Club or in any other organization. But you see in the church, because we're all bound together as family, like Jesus said, these are my brothers and my sisters, my mothers, my fathers.
Yeah, notice it's not coerced either. I mean, what passes for Christian charity in a sort of progressive mindset is raising taxes, you know, forcible confiscation of your money to redistribute, you know, amongst people indiscriminately, you know, perhaps needy. But you know, obviously within the church, it's pointed, specific, and generous and self-generated, which is which is a miracle.
Even Ananias and Sapphira are told specifically that their land was theirs to do with what they wanted, and even until it was sold, and even after it was sold, they could have done whatever they wanted with the proceeds. The problem was that they misrepresented themselves and lied to the Holy Spirit. I was involved with a church in Florida for a little while where their benevolence, it was a large church, and so a lot of homeless would sort of flock there on Sunday mornings or whenever they had an event, and they had a benevolence ministry that required the homeless who wanted services to check in before church, attend the service, and then check in after the service and then be served. And I'm sure that the new evangelicals, et cetera, would say that that was some sort of awful coercion. And how dare we have such a, you know, a high bar for people to clear before they receive our services. But I think that's the lowest possible version of what Jesus seems to be implying here, that just attending church one time and hearing the gospel doesn't make you a brother, but at least it's something.
Yeah, I think it's right. And we have a weekly soup kitchen, and we have a Bible study that meets, that starts in the middle of the soup kitchen. And so sometimes the idea is to try and sit down with people, invite them to this this Bible study. And we've actually had a number of people join our church from that who are, you know, kind of lower income and having a difficult time financially. And that's been great because it's been something for our people who have stepped up, and we have this pantry going now for just internally, so we can help people in our church who don't have enough money. We have a pantry that can come in every Sunday and get food out of it. But yeah, I mean, I think that this parable doesn't mean, of course, you don't help people who are not Christians. It's like if you see the non-Christian on the side of the road, you kick him and walk by because he's not a Christian, right? So no, that's not what it means. But it does mean there's a special care for the family. And we all, everyone understands that, no matter what those on the left of the current immigration debate might say, everybody understands that if I am struggling to feed my own family, that my primary concern is going to be doing that rather than, and people outside my family I care for, but I'm going to make sure my kids are fed first and foremost. And that's kind of the idea in the church, is we are a family now. So we're going to take care of our own. And we're also going to do our best to take care of those who wander in, those who are in our neighborhoods, those who are in the city, but never to the neglect of our own brothers and sisters in the church.
And of course, the best way to help those who would wander in or who are just in the highways and the byways is to make them brothers and sisters, to have them come into our communities,
right,
become part of our family, so that we can then, I mean, think about how much better you can care for somebody when you're in relationship with them than you ever could by any kind of interaction you might have on a street corner, no matter how generous you might be.
No, the best way is to give money to a large governmental organization,
right,
that will then filter it through the bureaucracy and pay all of their employees, and then, you know, some nameless person will nameless check will go out to some nameless person to get there. You know, so it's you're right, it's inhuman the way that we are encouraged to love our neighbor, quote unquote, by supporting leftist social policies in particular. Yeah, it has no relationship whatsoever with what the New Testament, with what Jesus has in mind when he talks about helping the poor and serving the needy.
I think this is where we can make a connection, perhaps a tenuous one, back to Columbus Day, when we think about the conquistadors or Columbus or whoever coming upon indigenous peoples who are, you know, engaging in tribal warfare, human sacrifice, all sorts of craziness, and imperfectly to be sure, but bringing them the good news of Jesus Christ. The attempt is to welcome them into a new family by which they will be better cared for. That's why you get clips on Columbus Day, people sharing, you know, that scene from The Sopranos where Tony Soprano says, "In my house, Columbus is a hero," because that's the first step to actually caring for the least of these, is to say, "You don't know Jesus. Let me introduce you to him."
Amen.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, there were millions of people who died as a result of Spanish colonization, but it wasn't the millions who died. That was not the Spanish didn't set out to do that. That was a result of importation of diseases that the indigenous population wasn't prepared to handle. And the Spanish didn't know anything about it. I mean, no one knew how diseases worked, at least the immune system worked back then. The intention was to, yes, I mean, we got to clearly the intention was to enrich Spain. Yep. But it was also to spread the church, to extend the kingdom of God to this new continent, into these people.
Well, and you have Columbus's diaries that say that explicitly. I mean, I was reading, you know, if you haven't read The Light and the Glory, that's a great book. And it's, you know, it has these firsthand accounts of Columbus. And it's interesting. It's two authors. Who is it? Marshall and Mandel, I think. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But he contrasts Columbus's piety with the gold lust of the Spanish conquistadors that followed, and argues that, you know, it's an interesting argument, but that there was a more success to like the Jesuit missionary work in southern North America and northern Mexico than the sort of ravages of the conquistador. I mean, that's his argument, at least, which I think it's a little heavy-handed all around, but it's an interesting counterbalance to what's being taught in the schools about how the bloodthirsty, barbarous conquistadors came and upset the peace-loving Fern Gully type, you know, one with nature. And I think that needs to be, I'm glad that for all sorts of reasons, but the free flow of information that is being reset in real time in people's minds, you know, just by pretty factual accounts of what I was reading. One that they were talking about how these were, you know, battle hardened Spaniards, you know, had crossed an ocean and they were like still shaken by the bloodthirstiness and the barbarism that they encountered, like the, you know, cannibalism and the women, men, and children all being sacrificed, and just how they were even shocked, you know, at the level of brutality. And it was really, it was fun to watch the back and forth yesterday on the two, you know, diametrically opposed understandings of what happened. I mean, it's, you know, we're being balkanized and I forget who said it, you know, the great sort is continuing down through history, you know, and you find yourself on one side or the other, where Columbus in this house is either a hero or a monster. You know, it doesn't seem to be a lot of nuance on this issue at this point.
Well, wasn't it pretty recently that the Pope apologized on behalf of the church for coming into conflict with indigenous religions? He was referring to Africa, I think, at that time. But this is the kind of indigenous religion that Christianity is called to overcome. The human sacrificial, these are the very kinds of religions that the Lord called his children to obliterate from the face of the earth. That's in right. Canaan.
These would be the literal high places that were to be torn down.
Mm-hmm. These would,
actually are the giant sacrificial temples that need to be razed to the ground.
And I mean, interesting that you have in the Old Testament, there are occasions when Jews, the descendants of Abraham, will run into legitimate worshippers of God who are not Jewish, like Melchizedek, right? Who's a genuine high priest of the Lord, but he's not, of course, related in any way to Abraham. He's meeting Abraham. And then you have the priest of Midian, Moses's father-in-law,
Jethro.
Jethro, right, who seems to be a legitimate priest of the Most High God, but he's not Jewish. And so you have this, it seems to me in the Old Testament, you have this kind of this vestigial memory of God left over from the ark that is retained in certain areas of the world still at the time of the patriarchs and of Moses. But and so you see that, like, when people talk about some of the similarities in indigenous religions across continents, I think you probably trace that back to,
right, there's one creator God.
Yeah, there's one creator God, right
they were all Second cousins, three times removed.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's why we've noticed this before on the podcast, but, like, you know, every
yeah, right. The flood story is so common throughout the world, it must be fake. It's like, no, actually the flood story is common because it really happened.
Right. But the reality is only the true knowledge of God was preserved within the sons and daughters of Abraham. And then that was fulfilled, the old covenant, of course, fulfilled in Jesus. And now we're going to these lost peoples. That's what the Spanish were doing. That's what the English were doing. That's what the Dutch were doing. That's what the Portuguese were doing. Going to these lost peoples who are our children of Abraham, or excuse me, children of Noah and of Adam, and restoring the image of God to them. So they have access to the real God that they were made to worship. So it's a great impulse. And you're right. Looking back on that from, you know, 500, however many years later, there are lots of things we can point at it that were wrong and abusive. We've already said this and shouldn't have been done. But I think there are millions upon millions of indigenous people in heaven right now who are thankful for Christopher Columbus, who are thankful for the British Empire, who are thankful for the Portuguese Empire and the other, the French, I guess even the French, who brought the faith to them they hadn't heard before.
Well, and it's not as if the Europeans aren't direct descendants of similar quote-unquote colonizing from Christian missionaries. You know, you think of the Irish and Patrick, you think of St. Augustine and the Brit, I mean, you know, or what's his name? Who was the first English missionary?
Augustine, just the other one.
Right, the other one. That's right.
Canterbury.
But we have, you know, and so, I mean, you know, Germanic tribes, Druids, the Norsemen, I mean, these were all bloodthirsty, you know, pagan religious societies that were centered around some form of human sacrifice, you know, and so they have been subdued, converted, restored, and then sent out. And that's the way of the world. And so what we're looking at now in a great reversal is that the now Christianized nations, or at least large parts of them, are sending missionaries back to the West to hopefully end the, in part, sacrifice that we're engaged in, in Western society in the same way, you know, between transhumanism ideology that's destroying people's bodies to euthanasia, to abortion, you know, we are just as bloodthirsty and just as self-sacrificial to our own God, which is autonomy, you know, in ourselves, as any Norse God was ever right. Thirsty enough. And so, you know, it's the pattern continues, you know, is that God is going to send by his mercy, imperfect and flawed sinners redeemed by his blood, who will preach some capacity, and those who hear will believe in the, you know, not all, but many. And, you know, we see the pattern of Christianization cross cultures and cross various ethnicities take a genuine biblical shape wherever it finds ground. You know, we see marriages become monogamous. You know, we see children being treated as actual human beings and not beings for our use and abuse. You know, we see men and women relate to each other differently. We see work being invested with a sense of purpose and meaning that it didn't have before. We see even the fear of death subside. You know, we see the rise of sort of reverent worship around the reality of death, but the hope of heaven. I mean, all the things, and that is in every language, every color, every.
It's worth noting that what you're saying is absolutely true, and includes what are often forgotten, more worldly things. Like, it includes beautiful architecture. It includes scientific discovery. It includes these things that literally make the world run because people thought that God made a world that could be understood.
That's right. Yeah, well, you see, I mean, at the very least, you see what the earliest sound of kind of conservative philosophers like Edmund Burke and people like this would say is that you see a respect for the rule of law and you see a provision for the common defense. You know, like, there's a recognition that governments exist. They're ordained by God for constraining evil, for protecting innocence and good. You see the reality of private property. You know, if you can't steal something that you know, if everyone owns everything. And so on and so forth. And what we're watching today is just this continued conversation that's been going on since we started this podcast, which was when the generation of people that had been taught the exact opposite of all these truths became sort of adults, you know, and they started teaching and they started interacting loudly in public. And we begin to have this deep conversation, which is continuing apace, if not just continuing to fracture, about whether or not, you know, what is the basis of Western civilization, whether or not it was a net good, you know, whether or not we should perpetuate it. And then the more importantly, how, you know, and of course, it's becoming increasingly a fruitless seeming endeavor to have the fruits, as we say, of Christianity without the root. You know, it seems that, you know, we can try to force people to care about taking, you know, going out in a storm and making sure the power lines are put back up. But it's increasingly more difficult to appeal to a sense of duty and a sense of higher transcendent calling in any of these areas when you have told people simultaneously that there is none, and yet you should act as if there is, even if we know that there isn't. And that's never been a really feasible idea. And we're watching in real time how it's failing, you know, around the West.
On the positive side of that ledger, though, is like people like Richard Dawkins and John Holland and others who are atheists, who aren't right. believing God, but they also are beginning to recognize, you know, look what we brought. Look what functional atheism does to a culture. It just, all it does is pave the way for the strong gods to come back and society to devolve into chaos and brutality. Even these atheists are seeing that they're calling. I think Richard Dawkins even calls himself a cultural Christian, or he at least he's been described that way. Mm-hmm. If he doesn't call himself that. And his colleague, I forgot her name, and it's hard to pronounce anyway, but she actually has become a Christian because of considerations of cultural devolution as a result of the West declining back into paganism. So, yeah, I think that what we see, though, interestingly, before Jesus, before the incarnation, there was some cohesion within paganism because the world was still under the thrall of the demonic. When Christ came, he on the cross, the demons were held up to, they were humiliated, they were defeated, their kingdom was thrown down. I mean, read the Gospels and consider the spiritual warfare going on there. And I'm not trying to be Pentecostal or anything, but just I'm not pulling Frank Zeretti, what is his name? It's Frank Zeretti.
Frank Peretti.
Peretti. That's a yeah. I'm not. But
don't
think,
say
but think
bad like, about this present darkness.
I know. I love those books. I'm a kid. But even when I wasn't a Christian, I love those books. But like demons are afraid of Jesus. He walks in. They're shaking. They're freaking out. They think the end has come because he's banishing the darkness from Israel. For those 3 years of his active earthly ministry, he cleansed the whole. The whole area of them, and they couldn't stand against him. And now that he's ascended into heaven and he rules there, the demons no longer rule the earth. They're here, but they don't rule. So when they come back, as they're trying to come back now in the West and other places, it's not nearly the kind of great civilizational construct that maybe Rome or Greece was. It's maybe first time is tragedy, second time is farce. I'm not sure what the phrase is there, but they are now is agents of depravity and chaos and our society.
Well, human self-destruction.
I mean, yeah, human self. They always were that, but now that Christ has defeated them, it's even more out of control. So that's why our country, we can't go back to the Roman gods and expect to thrive. We can't go back to the to the Norse gods and expect to thrive. We're turning back to the demonic, and we're seeing the outcome of that and mutilated children and murdered babies.
Yeah, it seems like some of these people need to go talk to first generation Christians around the world that have come out of explicitly pagan societies, you know, people that have had, you know, watched child sacrifice to witch doctors or shamans or something, or have gotten involved in the Buddhist like karma market. You know, I mean, you hear of these sort of wild stories that people have these testimonies about coming out of and into the peace and the newfound freedom that's in Christ alone. And you would have at least an appreciation for, well, maybe you would, that would blunt some of your vitriol against what you see as, you know, overreach of Christian imperialism. But then again, it's as we've talked about often, it's a spiritual problem, you know, and there's a hardness of heart and a blindness that doesn't want it to be true or willfully rejects it. And so there's, you know, I don't have a lot of hope for rational, calmed sort of debate, but I am encouraged nonetheless that, you know, that around the world, despite what's happening in the West, like Christianity is growing rapidly. I mean, quoted a statistic that I found in an article someone sent me in a sermon a couple of weeks ago that said in the past, so since 2000 in the US, Christianity has dropped 50%. So we have all been ministering to some capacity in that decline. I'm grateful to say that we are still standing, you know, but obviously 50% are not in this respect. But it also went on to say that since in the past 50 years, the number of Christians in the world has more than doubled. And so you have this incredible meteoric rise around the world of Christianity. They said that in China, that in 1949, there were approximately 3.5 million Christians. And today, the best guess is that it's at least 130 million Christians that are worshiping. And it's illegal there, you know? And so there's reason for great hope. And of course, as I said before, where you see genuine biblical Christianity embraced, you see a pattern emerge that speaks all different languages and has all sorts of different, you know, melanin levels, you know, and different ethnic dress and things, but they all relatively look the same because we're now related, you know, and Christian people, back to the original thing, are now related by the Spirit, adopted as sons and brothers who, you know, have various cultural uniqueness, but still over time, certainly over generations of being inculcated and conformed to the image of Christ, will begin to share familial traits and characteristics. And so that's what we see happen, what we have seen in every place that Christianity has been preached, you know, 100 years from that time, the culture, not the entire culture, but aspects that are explicitly Christian, have come into conformity with something of what the redeemed people of God would look like in an otherwise pagan world. And that's what we saw take place in first in Europe, and that's what we saw the Europeans bring. And now we're seeing the decline of it in the West, but at the same time, we're still seeing that happen all over the world in places where Christ is being preached. And I know that those people, I mean, I'm thinking specific bishops that I know in all over different parts of the world would say explicitly, we're expecting this to happen. Like, we want to happen what has already happened in your country and in your part of the world, in our country and in our part of the world, which is to watch people be conformed, lay down their former worship of idols and the following of myths, and submit to Christ and watch what happens over generations when that is believed, taught, and put into practice.
I remember that old Penn Jillette YouTube video. That's the atheist magician of Penn and Teller. He's the one who talks, though, where he had an interaction with a fan who came up to him and told him about Jesus and said, "Sir, I think you're going to hell. I hope you repent and believe in Jesus Christ." And the magician took to YouTube and said that he had great respect for that evangelistic effort, because if somebody actually believed that this is his words now, that I am going to hell, how cold-hearted do you have to be not to try to save me from that? And that's what Christian colonialism is, the fear that somebody else might die not having heard the good news. That's at least part of what the conquestors in North America were doing. That's at least part of what the British Empire was doing. That's at least part of what every Christian who shares Jesus at their Thanksgiving table is doing. It's sharing the good news that one more person might be saved.
Yeah. And that, being in a global communion ourselves, that's what our communion partners say when the African bishops I know and the African archbishops, they'll say, you brought us the gospel and now we have to bring it back to you because you've lost it.
So. Yeah, there's a great book to this end. It's a trilogy. I'm only halfway through the first one. So it's called Heaven's Command by a guy named Jan, or it might be a woman, Morris, I don't know. But at any rate, so the whole conceit is about the Victorian, you know, this was the height of colonialism under Queen Victoria, and the success of the abolition of the slave trade, particularly by the evangelicals, convinced them that that was just the first tip of the iceberg, that now they had the divine command to bring the gospel or to, you know, everyone, every area of the world. And it would be by extension, including things like abolishing slavery, but not stopping there, like ending societal ills, renovating morality and the legal system. And so they had this dual, both political and it was spiritual, but there's a self-consciousness to the colonialists, particularly in this case, this is about the English colonialists, that they were doing the Lord's work, that they were bringing, you know, that's what the light and the glory is about, that they were self-consciously saying this is a dark, unevangelized continent, and it needs the light of Christ. You know, it also needs the rule of law, and it needs all the other things that we're going to bring with it. And to the idea that human beings, flawed human beings, wouldn't have a conflicted hearts in all of this, and that there would be, you know, a lot of errors made and a lot of sins that needed to be atoned for, is part of the complexity of human history. And yet we watch over time those, like I said before, societies are transformed and reformed into, generally speaking, places where humans are, well, not killed, but taken care of, you know, where prisons are actually built and not just, you know, the people executed summarily without trial and so on and so forth. And so I'm increasingly sympathetic to Tony Soprano's sort of home teaching that in this house, Columbus is a hero, because we actually have a little homeschool curriculum that's based on this book, The Light and the Glory, that we're using for our children, that that doesn't pull any punches about the excesses of some of the more worldly concerned colonialists, but it certainly doesn't do away with the stated reasons for many of the devoted Christian people that they were involved in bringing the light of Christ to unreached people groups. And, you know, that's going to be something that's offensive to non-believers. It's always been offensive to non-believers, but it's also always been the central concern of the church. So, you know, we're going to continue to live in that tension, as they say, until we see him face to face, as we pray.
Amen. Thank you for listening to Stand Firm this week. That's going to be all the time we have today. If you want to keep the conversation going, please be in touch with us. You can rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com. Follow us on social media. Join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks, as always, to J.D. Koch and Matt Kennedy. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm. We'll be right back.